Good afternoon. I'm Gene Meyer, president of the society, and I am going to moderate, which means pretty much stay out of the way of this conversation between Judge Kaczynski and Judge Reinhart. I'm also going to be very brief in the introductions because both of them are extremely well known. They've both been for a quarter of a century judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. They both are extremely distinguished. They also both have conducted discussions like this at quite a number of places, including quite a number of Federal Society events. And I don't believe I've ever actually seen one of them before, so I am very much looking forward to this myself. So I am going without further ado to turn it over to them, and the first exciting question for me is which one of them is actually going to go first, because there's been discussion back and forth, and it's a little bit like the old to tell the truth, but the real person going first, please start speaking first. So without further ado, welcome to both of you. Thank you, Judge Reinhart, Judge Kaczynski, in whichever order.
He lost the toss. Well, I'm going first because I was misinformed as to what I was supposed to talk about by Judge Kaczynski's judicial assistant. So I'm going to say what I spent 2 or 3 hours last night learning about. I'm going to exhaust my knowledge on the subject of federalism and immigration, one of which I like, the other I'm not particularly thrilled about. In any event, I learned a few hours worth on the subject, and even though it's not our subject, I'm going to tell you what I know. Judge Kaczynski knows even less than I do about either of those subjects or the law in general. Now, I think I can sum up what I learned in a paragraph or so, and poses an interesting problem for people who believe in federalism who happen to be conservative. I don't know whether there are too many of those. I'm sure most of the federalists are liberals. But the problem with immigration and federalism is that the state, let's say the federal rules on immigration provide a lot of things that the states would like to go further on. The question there is, should the states be allowed to take actions like the state of Arizona, state of Alabama, 6 states recently, to adopt very tough legislation which makes it impossible for, illegal immigrants. I'm supposed to say people without documentation or without papers. But it makes it almost impossible for people who are here unlawfully to survive in those states. Some of the rules say you can't have housing if you don't have papers. That's in the one of the towns in Pennsylvania. Some of them say you can't work. In fact, you're not supposed to work anyway without papers. But there are a number of states, like Arizona, which you'll hear more about later, which have very strict laws which are directed at people who are here unlawfully. Those people, surprisingly, are not subject to criminal laws. They are, at least until they were enjoined, they are subject in Arizona, under the statute at least, to criminal penalties for being in this country without papers. Now, that means people who came here as students with papers and overstayed. It means other sorts of people who are here and are subject to deportation, but not to criminal prosecution. It's a civil violation to be here without papers. It's not a criminal law. Now, some states would like to make that a crime. And the question is, do the states have that right? Or is that a violation of the federal law? Well, a lot of people, and I would think a fair number of Federalists, would say that the state has the right to do whatever it wants within due process limits, and that the federal law does not prevent them from doing that. That's the right of the state. Now, the other side of the problem that I have discovered is that there are a number of municipalities, if not states, that don't want to follow the federal law because it's too strict on unlawful people here unlawfully. San Francisco, for example, was a sanctuary city. But there are places throughout the United States where the populace does not want to create problems by treating immigrants the way federal law does. For example, the police chiefs of this nation, a large number of them from large cities, do not want to abide by the federal rules which require them, whenever people are arrested, to turn them over to the feds or to turn their records in, their fingerprints in, to take their fingerprints. The police chiefs oppose that kind of law because it makes it difficult to get many people to cooperate with the police. If they know that by cooperating with the police, they're exposing themselves, their neighbors, others, to being turned over to ICE, they don't want to cooperate, and they don't cooperate with the police, which makes law enforcement much more difficult. Now, under some of the statutes, they will be required to do that. It's not a voluntary program, they say, and in 2013, it becomes mandatory for all law enforcement agencies to do this. That's being resisted strongly by people who believe in federalism and believe that the localities and the states should have a right to determine to what extent they want to cooperate with law enforcement that the federal government dictates. There's also a theory that that's a mandate, that, you know, how bad mandates are. In any event, that's a mandate that that the federal government imposes on law enforcement, that it must use its resources to turn in anyone that they fingerprint, that that's not something that the federal government can do. The point of what I learned from this 2 or 3 hours preparing for a topic I'm not supposed to talk about is that federalism raises a question on both sides with these immigration laws and rules. If you believe that the federal government has the right to do what it wishes in the area of regulating the conduct of people who have entered unlawfully, and that the federal government has achieved certain balances in the laws it has adopted, particularly in the field of employment, and of what kind of punishment. It's really the employers that the immigration laws put the burden on rather than the workers. But they've balanced these things to come up with a policy that the federal government believes gives appropriate weight to all of the policy considerations. Now, do you believe that that policy is one that the states and the communities must respect, or can they have their own policies? If they can have their own policies, some of them are going to be stricter and tougher than the federal government's policies. On the other hand, some of them are going to be more lenient, and they're not going to require the kinds of police action or law enforcement action that, in fact, the law enforcement chiefs don't themselves want. In any event, this whole subject raises very serious questions about federalism, and one on which liberals and conservatives can very strongly disagree. I think the conservatives are very much for the kinds of tougher enforcement that states seek to impose. I think it was the Pennsylvania one, the town in Pennsylvania that says, in effect, you can't live in our town. And liberals are going to be very much for federalism when it comes to the rights of cities and communities not to abide by the federal policy that you have to turn over to the FBI and to ICE the fingerprints of every person that you arrest for any reason. I wonder how many people are consistent and say that whether it's a more lenient or a stricter policy. I take the same view, either that the federal government predominates and states and communities can't deviate, or take the view that yes, the states can, whether it's more lenient or more strict. Well, anyway, that's what I learned in 2 or 3 hours last night, and I just thought I would pose that as a problem for federalism as well as liberal and conservatives. Now, what do you know about this?
I think the case you were thinking of is Lausanne versus City of Hazleton. That was the name of the city. And for those of you who are taking CLE credits, it's 620 Fed 3rd at 170. An interesting opinion by Judge McKee. As you've seen today, the fact when it comes having spent a quarter of a century having Judge Reinhardt as a colleague, the fact that he doesn't know anything on the subject never stops him from speaking with great authority. And wisdom. You know, he's pretty good on his feet. I didn't spend those 2 or 3 hours that he called me in desperation last night saying, Donna, my secretary, had told him this was about federalism, and he said, I don't know anything about it. I said, I don't know anything about it either, but we'll get to it. And the reason I don't know anything about this, I don't think there is a real theory of federalism. It's one of those things like motherhood and apple pie and all those other, you know, American flag. Everybody is for federalism. I mean, really, it's nobody out there says, gee, federalism, horrible stuff, we're against it. It's one of those values, one of those things that after you decide a case a particular way, if federalism helps you, you throw it in as a consideration. You say, well, and this serves the values of federalism. Ta-da! In fact, I don't think there is any justice in the Supreme Court, with the possible exception of Justice Thomas, that has a theory of it. He applies consistently. Even Justice Thomas, I don't think, does. I mean, take a couple of cases just from the last few years from the Supreme Court. Take Raich. This was the medical marijuana case. And if you recall, the question there was, does growing pot at home for medicinal purposes, when the state says it's legal for you to do so under state law, you don't sell it, you don't give it away to anybody else. It's all for your own consumption, authorized by state. Is that something that's covered or can be properly covered by the federal criminal law under the Commerce Clause? Now, I can talk about the case because it's been decided, and here's how I would have approached the case, which is not really that different from the way Justice Thomas did. What I would have said is, first of all, there's no transaction involved. There's no buying or selling. You are just growing it yourself. Sure, you have to buy the land and the seeds, and eventually you connect up to the economy because everything connects to the economy, but there really is no purchase or sale going on there. Another thing I would have said is, you know, this is a matter having to do with health. And health is a matter that is peculiarly, under our federalist notions, something that is regulated by the state. Federal government has an interest, but it's of particular interest, the regulation of health and the healthcare profession in general is one of the areas where local control has been part of the values of federalism. So I would have said, in that situation, just like when you're talking about schools, in the school, the case involving guns in school, that's another area of local concern. So it seems to me that if it's a close issue, the tie should go, if you're really a Federalist, the tie should go to the local authorities. In that case, what it would have meant is that you would say this is not something truly affecting interstate commerce. Supreme Court, in the opinion of Justice Stevens, who was a really brilliant guy and very canny and managed to bamboozle his colleagues into joining his opinion, that resurrected what I thought was by then a dying case, Wickard versus Fulbright. Remember, that's the case from the Depression era that I thought was the worst case I had ever read in law school. I couldn't believe that anybody, much less Supreme Court justice, would sign on to it, that said when you grow your own wheat and eat it, that affects interstate commerce. And I remember shouting out, saying, that's wrong. I was sitting right there in the front row. I said, no, it's not possible. How can you possibly? And my professor said, well, you know, there are different theories about this. You know, economists disagree on this subject as to whether it affects interstate commerce. So they resurrected Wickard versus Fulbright and held that, yes, this is properly the subject of criminal law, whether you grow pot in your backyard. Grow pot in your backyard to deal with what the state believes is a legitimate medical condition to create relief for that the state authorities believe is a proper medical procedure. Justice Thomas is the one who signed on to. There were two other dissenters; they are no longer on the court. One of them is Chief Justice Rehnquist, and the other one was Justice O'Connor. So, as best I can tell. And we don't know, I rather doubt that Chief Justice Roberts will agree with, would step in the shoes of Chief Justice Rehnquist in that one. And I doubt Justice Alito would agree with Justice O'Connor. So I think all we've got is Justice Thomas left, pretty much. The other case that I want to sort of mention in saying that there's really not a great theory of federalism is the Seattle, the Parents Involved case. This is a case that came out of our circuit. My good friend and colleague, Judge Baird, and I disagreed on this great deal. He was vindicated by the Supreme Court. But I still think I was right. This, you recall, was a situation where the Seattle school authorities, and this is by vote of the public, this was not just the authorities, this was by it was several times put to a vote and a great deal input for the local community. And what they did is they would shift students around somewhat to create a slightly better balance in terms of diversity. So this would combat the effect of the fact that people tend to live in neighborhoods with people like themselves. Often people of the same race, same color, same ethnic origin often live in neighborhoods. The effect is that the children winds up, they go to local schools, go with school with children just like themselves. City thought it would be a good idea to have people, children grow up, having classmates that look different from themselves. Again, I thought this was something that local authorities should reasonably be entitled to do. This was not a situation where one race was given a preference or plus factors. This was a way to get people, young children, to grow up having classmates that don't look quite like themselves. Do I agree with that as a policy matter? I don't know. I'd have to think about it. But I certainly think this is the kind of decision that parents with their local authorities should be able to make for their children. And if you really believe in federalism, if you really believe that you give the edge on local matters to local authorities, you would think that you would go for the you would affirm that kind of plan. The Supreme Court disagreed; it was a badly split opinion. But the conservatives, the ones that I would have thought would be most interested in federalism, were the ones that struck down the plan. So it gets us to this immigration case, and I really can't talk about it because it's now pending for the Supreme Court. I read the opinion, it came out of our court. My good colleague, Judge Beyer, dissented. And not having read the briefs or anything else, just having sort of looked at the case, I must say I thought Judge Baer's dissent was quite persuasive, unlike his position in the other case where I disagree. It's perhaps because I studied that one more closely. No, I'm joking. But I did not study the case closely. I didn't hear argument, but I just thought, based on what I saw there, I thought Judge Baer had the better of the argument. I can't tell you what the Supreme Court would do, but it seems to me that what you've got to play, there are two really different sort of opposing forces. You've got the fact that immigration law is inherently a federal function. This is an area that you cannot have different immigration laws for by different states. It wouldn't work. It's the kind of thing that tore us apart when we had the Articles of Confederation. You cannot have one state admitting some immigrants and another state not, and because of course we are a nation, and once you come in, you know you're free to travel the 50 United States. So that, I think that is a policy that, in terms of federalism, should favor the federal government and should narrow the scope of what the state can do. On the other hand, immigration tends to have immense effect on local concerns. Schools, roads, employment, safety, you know, all the things that large populations create, litter, vagrancy, law enforcement, all of those things are important local values. And it seems to me that states like California, Arizona, and other Texas, other border states, have this problem far more acutely than someplace like Minnesota. It's a border state too, but it's a border state with Canada, and we don't have a lot of people sort of coming in from Canada. It's a, simply a different economy. Canada's economy much more like their own, our own, so people don't tend to flood across the border, whereas south of the border, it's just the reality is that the economy south of the border is much worse. I mean, if you have traveled across the border, you can tell when you cross over. It's a different country. And the attractions of American economy and American education and American work opportunities are just too great. So people are attracted across the border. So it seems to me that states, the border states, do have a legitimate federalism-related claim to having to being given some deference in enforcement of immigration laws at the local level. Now, how the Supreme Court will decide, I can't tell you. As I say, on simply reading the opinions we had, I thought Judge Baer had the better of the argument, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, it's not so easy just to say border states have some rights. Yes, they have some rights, but where the fight comes is what rights? Alabama statute that when it was passed, all the workers left Alabama. All the foreign workers left Alabama. They found themselves suddenly unable to produce their products. And within a week or two, the Attorney General and some of the other leaders of Alabama said, we've got to do something about this. You know, we've gone too far. Now, does that mean that you can leave it up to each state and they can drive out all of the people if they want? Well, yes, you can be here, but you can't function. When there's an immigration policy that allows people to come into the country, that does that mean that a state can say, sure, you can come into the country, sure, you're welcome, but you can have no place to live, you're not allowed to rent a place, you're not allowed to have a job, you're not allowed to go to school, you're not allowed to drive on our roads. You add it all up, and you're not saying, you can come to our country, you can come to our state. It's not an easy problem, unfortunately. You have to decide issue by issue what part is consistent with federal policy that, as Judge Kaczynski says, you're welcome, you can be here, you can stay in the country. What makes it consistent with that When is it consistent with federal policy? And when has a state adopted rules that are really, in practice, inconsistent with that? That's the issue, and the kinds of things I mentioned, they are not fictional. Those are the real issues in the states that have already passed some of these laws. If you take the general idea, whatever is consistent with federal law of allowing these people to live as human beings in our states, and the states must respect that, then you get to the difficult questions. So I suppose that in general, Judge Kaczynski and I would agree. When it comes to anything that matters, the specifics, that's where we would probably disagree. I didn't much care for Judge Bea's opinion, for example.
Well, see, we disagree even now because we disagree with in phrasing of the question. I don't see this as being a federal policy of open arms coming across the border, even though it's illegal, and you're welcome to come here and stay and work, and so long as we don't catch you. I believe the federal policy is, no, you are supposed to stay out. You're not supposed to come in. We have inspections at the border. We have border patrols. If we catch you coming in, we send you right back, or we arrest you. So there is no federal policy of having people come here and work illegally. What there is a policy of what I would call, and I don't mean this in any way in a pejorative sense, but I don't know how I'm going to say it otherwise, of lax enforcement. If you ever go to the border, I mean, when I say lax, it's really quite stringent. I mean, they patrol, they've got trucks, they've got demilitarized zones, they've got two fences, and, you know, so there is a great deal of resources devoted to keeping people out who are not authorized to be in this country. At that, it's not nearly enough to keep people out, and if you really wanted to keep people out, you would sort of double or triple the effort, and you would give some real teeth to people who actually just make it across the border. If you, for example, go to Mexico and try to work without having authorization, you get put in prison. You get put in jail. You are immediately criminally a criminal. In this country, we do have a federal policy that you will not be arrested the first time. You will maybe sent back. You may be sent back 5 or 6 times before they even think about the possibility of having a formal deportation, and it's only after you have a formal deportation that coming back becomes a felony. So sort of phrasing the question that somehow we have a federal policy that welcomes illegal aliens, undocumented workers, it's just not true. It's one way of phrasing the question, but I don't think it's the most fair way of phrasing the question. Once you recognize that federal policy is that you can't come in, you shouldn't come in unless you have authorization, then it becomes a much closer issue as to whether or not you let states back that up with their own local laws.
Now we come to the problem that I think is very real. It's I heard 2 Republican debates, to my misfortune. In one, I heard Governor Perry say people who don't go along with this policy of tolerating people who are there, of treating them decently, are inhumane. Well, Michelle Bachmann almost drove him out of the race when he said that. Most recently, I heard Newt Gingrich say, we can't, you know, we have 11 million people living in this country. We can't act as if they weren't here. We can't act as if we're suddenly going to send back 11 million people who have children, who've gone to school, who've served in the military. They have families here. And Newt Gingrich kept saying, well, you can't go in and arrest these grandmothers. Well, Mitt Romney, that great statesman, said they're not all 11 million grandmothers. Well, that's not a very satisfactory answer. Newt Gingrich was trying to say, with some compassion, We can't split up these families. They have people in these families who've been here for 20, 30 years. You know, their parents brought them across the border when they were 3 years old. They didn't ask to be brought across. They've been raised as Americans. They've gone to our schools. They've held our jobs. You read some of these immigration cases. They get very excited when they find out they go to church every week. These are people who were brought here as children, but they were raised as real Americans. I don't know about Governor Romney's past and his family and how they got here, but he mentioned that too. He mentioned part of it. But in any event, you can't just say, oh, these are people who crossed the border. Now they're not allowed to work. They can't do anything. Send them all back. Next time they come, we'll do something. You're not going to send 11 million people who have lived as real Americans back. And not only can't you send them back because it's inhumane, although Governor Perry learned not to say that word to a Republican audience. It's not only that. If we sent the 11 million people back tomorrow in some of our states like California, I don't know how we'd function. They have lots of jobs that we need. We're dependent on those people. It's not only for them that you can't send 11 million people back, but it's for us, it's for our economy. You can't just act and say, our policy is, if you do it again, you're out again. That's not our policy. It may not be official, but this country accepts the fact that there are 11 million people here who are not here with papers. And we have to find some way to accommodate that. And you might say that the best way to accommodate it is to have a federal policy. I'm not suggesting that at this time. It's a difficult question with issue by issue about what you're going to do when you have a nation that has 11 million people who don't have papers.
You know, at least Republicans have debates.
Well, we'll have debates when there's somebody to debate with, whether it's Michelle Bachmann, Governor Perry, Newt Gingrich, one of your wonderful candidates.
I'm sure they'd be glad to debate Obama.
I must say, it was striking to hear you, Judge Reinhardt, I guess I shouldn't say endorse, but support both Governor Perry and Newt Gingrich in the same paragraph.
I learn a lot when I listen to my right-wing friends.
People generally learn a lot when they listen to people with whom they don't agree from whatever perspective. We could all probably stand to do more of that.
I've been trying for years.
I wanted to defend or protect Judge Kaczynski's secretary.
He needs a defense.
No, his secretary. Donna, because we are, in addition to this, I want to throw out another question, because by all means continue with this if you want to, but I wanted to throw out a more general question, which is, what do you think the role of a judge ideally should be? I know both of you have talked about this a lot, but I thought it would be a good thing to have a little bit of an exchange on. Maybe Judge Reinhardt first.
Well, it depends on the type of case. I think the most important role of a federal judge is to protect people's rights under the Constitution. And that means not bowing to majoritarian pressure or will. It means doing unpopular things, like saying under God shouldn't be in the Pledge of Allegiance. It's the whole purpose of the Bill of Rights is to protect the minority against the majority that won't voluntarily abide by the Bill of Rights and give them those rights. That's why you need a federal court. And that's why, thank God, we're not subject to elections. That, I think, is the most important function of a federal judge. Now, we do a lot of other things with a lot of other different cases, some of which, for instance, where stability is the most important thing. If you have business cases, like what kind of a contract will be recognized because we have, diversity cases. There it may be more important in business cases to protect precedent. So the people who are trying to organize businesses, enter into contracts, know what they can do and what they can't do.
Unless there's a union involved.
We do have, despite what number of people wanted until, thank God, we elected Franklin Roosevelt, up until then, now that you ask, the role of the federal courts was to protect big business. The role of the federal courts has always been in this country, at least until the New Deal, is a very conservative institution, which was its mission was to protect the status quo, protect the wealthy who are in a dominant position, and protect them particularly against the rights of workers, protect the institutions. I don't want to mention Governor Romney again after hearing from the last debate.
Why don't you talk about Governor Reagan when he was governor of California?
California, he was really great. He brought us abortion. He brought us a number of excellent things. He changed his views when he became president. But the role of the judge historically in this country was to protect the status quo. It changed when the New Deal came, and we had new legislation which gave people the right to organize, to join unions, much as you may not like that word, to take collective action to protect the rights of people who were being oppressed by the group that these days pays almost no taxes. There is a function for unions. And it is to protect the people who need protection. And to some extent, that's also the role of the federal court, although that's been being diminished since the 1970s, where we have courts that care far less about the rights of people that need the protection of the federal government and the judicial system.
Judge Reinhardt used to be a union lawyer in his earlier life, so I knew I could get a rise out of him by mentioning unions. I don't disagree with much of what Judge Reinhardt said, but I would put it a little bit differently. I think, the most important thing you can do as a federal judge at all is to decide a case. Cases fairly on the merits, this seems sort of simplistic, but it's really important. Part of what that means, a big part of what that means, is of course not letting your own views or your own preferences, your own policy views, preferences, play a determinative role in the decision-making process. We're all sort of an outgrowth of our own upbringing. I don't think Judge Baer, for example, will ever forget the fact that he was once on a deportation list, right? It's something he's aware of, and when he looks at cases, this is something that comes back to him. I'm an immigrant. I came to this country. I have my experience. I lived under communism. All of those things go to make up who I am. But I think it's also really important, and it's important not to forget those things because we are pointed to what, to some extent, because of our experiences, in light of our experiences. But I think it is very easy as a judge to fool yourself into thinking that your view of policy or your preferences of a case should come out are really a decision on the merits. And I think the important thing you have to do as a judge, and you have to constantly do as a judge, is to second-guess your own gut instincts about the case. Particularly the closer, difficult cases, the cases involving issues that are of great public interest and public significance. And the temptation to try to decide cases and to try to sort of use the creativity at your disposal and the inherent indeterminacy of the law to come out to the result that you really like is quite strong and sometimes overwhelming. And I think you have a responsibility as a judge to fight that constantly. Now, having said that, I do think that in doing that process, you will protect individual rights, and you will protect individual rights even when doing so is unpopular. Even so, and it's important to have the independence of which Judge Reinhardt speaks in making decisions fairly on the merits. But sometimes, you know, the union loses. Sometimes the employer wins. You know, sometimes capitalism triumphs. You know, and even and sometimes it doesn't. So I think it is important to step back, particularly on those cases that are likely to be blogged about, or likely to go up to the Supreme Court, or likely to have deep public impact, like the school, the Pledge of Allegiance case, to think carefully, make sure that the what you're doing is really more than wishful thinking, that it's really deciding the case on the merits to the best of your abilities.
The problem with this is, you know, the cases that are the cases that come to public attention are not decided on the facts by people who... you get nine people. They're all honest, decent people. Whether they should all be judges is another question. But you know, but they do what they believe. You know, they happen to believe different things. That's why you get 5-4 votes all the time. It's not that somebody is saying, "Oh, I'm not going to follow the law." You know, the Justice Thomas is saying that, or Justice Stevens was saying that. You had very regular disagreements, 5-4, based on philosophical views. You had that during the Warren era, too. It's just that there are different views of what the law is, what the Constitution means. It's not that one's following the law and the other group isn't. Each group thinks it's following the law as it sees its job, as its function, and to implement the Constitution as it understands the Constitution. I don't think Judge Kaczynski would tell you that the five conservatives on the court follow the law, see the facts, they decide the facts, that's what a judge should be, and that the others, like Justice Stevens was, like the four moderates on the court now, that the four moderates don't do what Judge Kaczynski says, and only Justice Thomas and his four allies do. You know, I mean, that's just, I don't think it's naive. I don't think you think you'll fool people. But that's not the difference. It's just that there is a clear division in philosophy, and that affects and the way they see the Constitution, and that affects the way they decide cases.
So you're okay with Bush versus Gore, then?
No, I didn't say their cases were all properly decided.
I see. I just wanted to clarify that.
No, that case is a disgrace.
Why? 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 Tell us. I mean, you know, after all, everything is indeterminate.
I said there are good judges who make bad decisions.
So you think the liberals in that case betrayed equal protection?
I think they betrayed him.
Yeah, you know.
That case is, fortunately, that case is unique.
Yeah. And they told us it's unique.
And almost nobody defends it.
We're going to take some questions from the audience. I'll ask one more question as people line up, spinning off the start of the last answer. How important or valuable or not valuable is creativity in your jobs?
In his, it's great. It's really, really.
Well, I have to worry about the Supreme Court, particularly when I agree with you. I think it's more important when you're on the Supreme Court because you have the ability to do things. You're not bound by the way a circuit court judge is. But, you know, there are a lot of cases where the answer is not so clear. It's usually, in an important case, the court doesn't act unanimously. They disagree, too. It's you know, it's not the kind of a job where you just say, okay, here's the answer. I push the computer and it tells me the answer. The reason you need judges as people who are supposed to have wisdom, that's one of the things you're supposed to have. Some of us do, some don't. But it's not an automatic answer to these difficult questions or to questions that involve policy or the Constitution. Even the less fascinating cases, you just can't go to a book and get the answer. It needs, I think creativity is something you find a lot in the courts, less in the courts of appeals than in the Supreme Court. But imagination, creativity, wisdom, intelligence, understanding, compassion, which turned out to be a terrible thing that Obama said. God, you might have a little humanity. God forbid you should have humanity and be a judge. But those are the qualities I think are important in a judge.
Well, when you bob and weave around Supreme Court precedents the way Judge Reinhardt does, you need a lot of creativity.
That doesn't work very often.
Doesn't keep him trying. like a lot of things, creativity is a two-edged sword. I think it can be important because some of what we need to do does require occasional bursts of creativity to see sort of the clear picture. My co-clerk, Richard Woolard, who was mentioned, Ed Meese, I met Ed Meese when we were both working for Judge Kennedy in Sacramento. That guy could just look at a bunch of cases and just crystallize a doctrine, a principle out of them. I would look at the same bunch of cases, and to me they were just gibberish. They were all inconsistent. So the ability to sort of see the bigger picture does require a certain amount of creativity and to sort of understand the trends of the law. The problem is that people get enamored of their own creativity, and often it is used as a way not of clarifying things, but a way of avoiding the clear and inevitable result. You find something that really persuades you is pure creativity, is a distinguishing characteristic, or something that makes this case different from other cases. In fact, it's not true. It's just you become a victim of your own creativity. And I think that's a danger. I think that's a real danger for judges.
Yes.
Your Honors, first of all, thank you for the little family discussion. It's always nice to have a little family, a friendly family feud to enlighten us all. I have a concern about kind of the 150,000-pound elephant in the living room. Maybe it's a donkey in the living room, I'm not sure. But the idea is that we're dealing with passion versus politics in how we deal with the families that are here, the children that were brought here that have gone through school and married their high school sweetheart, U.S. citizen. They have families of their own, the Dream Act kids, in other words. And then how does that gel with the fundamental right to marriage in this country when we have such a draconian enforcement policy that would separate these families? So maybe you could kind of help resolve how those issues would be resolved. I understand, going back to the old Steamship versus Stranahan case, that this is an area that should be exclusively federal jurisdiction. But what do you do when the federal government refuses or is incapable of implementing a reasonable policy? Thank you.
You sort of give a hypothetical case that I'm a little have trouble dealing with, because if you marry a U.S. citizen, you get papers, so I'm not entirely sure I follow all that. If you have a felony in the meantime, then you have a different situation. So,
Your Honor, I wonder if I might clarify.
Yeah.
Pardon me for interrupting. If somebody has not been inspected and admitted into the border, or they don't qualify under 245I prior to April 30, 2001, then the requirement is they leave the country. The minute they're stepping outside the country, even for immigration processing, they're barred from reentry for 10 years unless they can meet the extraordinary standard of extreme and unusual hardship to their U.S. citizen petitioning spouse. So there, that's what I mean, Your Honor. We're separating families for those 10 years. It just seems like a draconian process that I think is largely misunderstood.
I'm not going to get into a discussion of the nuts and bolts of immigration law, except to say I believe you're wrong. And I really just can't talk about specific cases. But it seems to me sort of the more general answer to this is a kind of situation that we, as a political body, can deal with. And if we, as a political body, decide that situations like that merit compassion and merit leniency, then that's what we ought to do, and that's what this legislation that I've proposed are about, and that's why we're having a debate. Of course, one of the consequences of doing this is that you encourage further such conduct in the future. If you grant leniency now, this will tell next generation, well, you should come in, and then there'll be another act of leniency. I don't take a view on this. I enforce the law as it is written, if that means that it's a harsh result, I think Judge Reinhardt will join me in agreeing that we ought to do the very unpopular thing if that's what the law requires, no?
Well, I'd say two things about it. Yes, fundamentally, it's a problem for the legislative and executive branch. Using a little creativity, occasionally you can find a way to treat people decently, despite the law. But it's not the normal thing that we can do. These cases come from the Board of Immigration Appeals to our court. And we have to follow what, when there's a bad law, an unfair and unjust law, we still have to follow it, except in the exceptional case where you can find a loophole. But that's not the normal case. I have often gone home at night and said, is this why I became a judge? To throw people out of the country and separate them from their families? Some of the immigration cases we get are horrible, but there's not much we can do about them. The reason that's not solved in Congress is something you all know. It's a political dispute. It's argued on a political basis. One party doesn't want to cooperate with another party. The administration has found a way where we can minimize the problem, and they have adopted process rules. You know, as I mentioned before, there are 11 million people you could throw out if you wanted to, and we're not going to. So the administration's answer to this is to give priorities and to start at the very top with people who have committed serious crimes. Those people, I think, people generally might support growing out of the country. There may be enough of those to keep us busy for years. The bottom categories that they have are people with families who've been here for a fair amount of time, who've been law-abiding citizens. If we follow those priorities, the kinds of things you care about are going to be taken care of by the laws of nature. We'll never get down to number 11 million. So I think it can be taken care of if the administration's priorities are followed. There's difficulty, as always, when you're dealing with a bureaucracy, in getting them to follow sensible rules. And there's always opposition. I hate to mention it because of Judge Kaczynski's reference to my past. But in this case, it's the union that is providing the greatest obstacle to following those rules. But we can't directly do a lot about it. but we may be able to help influence the policies of the Congress, or more likely, the administration.
So clearly in the micro, if you're being deported...
Can you speak into the mic? I'm having trouble hearing you.
Yes. Clearly, if you're being deported, you know, you're better off if you can stay here. And clearly, if any of us were born in Mexico and we knew what we know now, we would all cross the border, right? Because we all know that we'd have better job options. That would just be the smart thing to do. So we have this, we have the most motivated people in Mexico who clue in to how corrupt the government is in Mexico. They cross the border, they come in here, and they work, right? If we were to get serious and actually deport a large percentage of them, or make it hard for them to work here and have them go back, I mean, Mexico might have a revolution. They might actually fix their government, right? This is a release valve for Mexico, right? The people who would be most likely to turn on the corrupt government clue in and cross the border. And instead of us stopping them and forcing Mexico to deal with all their corrupt issues, we allow them in, and we are sort of, you know, enabling the corruption in Mexico. And then on top of that, we add all our other, you know, local problems, right, of extra government costs of people and all, you know, the fact that some jobs get taken over that would otherwise be, and maybe wages go down.
Do you have a question?
So, you know, what do you think? Don't you think that you've only talked about the sort of the narrow, the micro of the individual person and how it, you know, it does. It breaks anybody's heart to say, yeah, we're going to toss you back to Mexico, which none of us would want to be deported to. But don't you think in the bigger picture, you know, both countries would be better off and Mexico would be more likely to be a better country?
I don't have a view about Mexico being a better country. I just don't know. I think for us it is to enforce the law as it is written. But I think Judge Reinhardt does have a point. I think we, as a practical matter, we in the federal courts can't handle every case. It's just not enough time, so they tend to be stacking up. So all things considered, I think it's probably best to deal with those who have committed felonies and therefore are dangerous and likely to cause harm, as opposed to those further down the list. Doesn't mean that's a great policy or that's a good policy or they shouldn't have a better policy, but I think it's certainly reasonable.
We have 4 minutes left and two people at the microphone, so I'm going to try to get through both questions. Yes.
Why don't conservative Republicans talk about judicial activism when the Supreme Court strikes down a local ordinance of the District of Columbia, Heller versus District of Columbia, regarding a ban on guns in a home? Where were the conservative Republicans talking about judicial activism when that type of ordinance was thrown out by a court, a democratically resulted ordinance being thrown out? And where are the conservative Republicans talking about an attempt to get a judicial activist court to strike down federal law, Obama health care? Why aren't the conservative Republicans talking about an attempt to use activism, judicial activism, to strike down democratically enacted statutes?
Well, when you have a panel involving Republicans, you can ask that question. We're judges.
I'm not a member of the... Thank you.
So, Judge Kaczynski has indicated his view on the Raich case. I'm curious to hear the moderate on the panel describe your take, Judge Reinhardt, on Raich, and particularly recognizing, I think we all agree, we have a constitution of limited powers. We support individual rights under our constitutional and federalist structure. How do you look at Raich, and would you have done the same thing that Justice Thomas did?
Well, Manny, I hope you never call me a moderate again.
I was using your terminology. I thought you said there were...
I was referring
to... I used to say Pinko, and he loves it.
I was referring to the four members of the Supreme Court who are on the right of the reactionaries.
Well, I thought if Justice Ginsburg is a moderate,
you
would feel comfortable about being called a moderate.
Who? Which justice?
Ginsburg.
Ginsburg?
Ginsburg.
Yeah, she's a moderate, right? Yeah. I'll tell you a story someday when we have lunch or something about Justice Ginsburg and her political role at a place on the spectrum. But no, I think that nobody would. There's not a member of the court that would admit to being a liberal. I think the five right-wingers would not be offended by being described as conservative unless anyone said, when any one of them said, you're not going far enough. But they've been asked, the four have been asked. And, you know, Justice Stevens, who was to the left of those four, was a moderate Republican when he was appointed. And he said, as was Justice Blackmun, and Justice Stevens said that every single appointment since I've been on the court has been to the right of the person who was replaced. Justice Stevens also says, I haven't moved. I'm still a moderate Republican. But the court's moved. The court has moved far to the right. So he wouldn't consider it an insult to be called a moderate. And he's much more liberal than the four moderates left.
Well, aside from the nomenclature, right. would you agree with Judge Kaczynski that Justice Thomas got it right in his dissent in the Raich case?
I don't remember Justice Thomas's dissent, but I thought that the result was wrong.
Okay, we're on the right path.
Okay, we're on the same side. You know, we're often on the same side.
About half the time, I think is what you would say. That's the thing about libertarians. People disagree with us half the time.
On that note, I want to thank very much our panelists.